Welcome to Big Blend Radio with your hosts, Lisa and Nancy, editors of BigBlendMagazine.com.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome to Big Blend Radio's monthly Military Monday show. We air this show every first Monday of the month. Today is May 3rd, 2021, and we're airing live from historic Madison, Wisconsin. It is historic. A lot is going on in this beautiful city, and it is great to be back. The last time we were here was pretty much all of December and early January when there was a lot of snow, and today there's dandelions and flowers everywhere and a lot of green. Nancy, it's good to be back, right?
Well, it's totally great to see something totally different in the same spot just because the season changed.
It's amazing. It is beautiful. And there's lakes. We're in the capital city. And they do have military aircraft going above us. I think they're F-15s. I may be wrong. So
14.
No, I don't think so. Mike Forty is on the show. He may tell us if we're right or wrong. But everyone, we're your hosts, Nancy Reed and Lisa Smith, the mother-daughter travel team. We travel full-time on our Love Your Parks tour, where we document parks and public lands and share the stories of the communities in our publications. We have Big Blend Radio and TV Magazine and also Parks and Travel Magazine. Check it all out at BigBlendMagazines.com. Today's show, we welcome back U.S. Army veteran and acclaimed author and military historian Mike Guardia. He's joining us as guest co-host once again, because if we do anything military, we want him by our side, seriously. And because it doesn't matter. You can ask him anything. He knows it. To this day, one day we'll have to play 100 questions with him because he really does know so much. He's joining us to talk about his brand new book. It's called Days of Fury, Ghost Troop and the Battle of 73 Easting. And welcome back, Mike. How are you?
Lisa and Nancy, thank you so much. It is awesome to be back on the show. I'm doing great. How are you two?
We're doing good.
We're doing awesome. It's green and beautiful. What's it like in Minnesota today?
Pretty much the same. Finally glad the cold weather's behind us now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, now we know, you did shows with us while we were in Tucson, Arizona, Yuma, Arizona, and sunshine, and, you'd call up and say, it's 20 degrees or something, and we're like, dude, that's really cold, but we really couldn't feel it until we got here.
But now we know.
Now we know what you're talking about. But you know what? It was a great experience, and I honestly would do it again. I don't know why. Maybe I just feel like I need the workout of shoveling snow. I don't know. But it was really cool to be here now and cool to be there, back this winter. But I'm excited to talk about Days of Fury. I think this, your books really get into battle strategies, but also really, I think, through the years of talking to you on Big Blend Radio, you really seem to give a perspective of soldiers and what they're going through in the field and how they've had to make decisions and how to plan a battle or do something like this isn't going as planned, so we're going to make a change. Wouldn't you say that's really what you do, Mike, is you're sharing the story of what went down, but really, I know that your books are definitely the military. Men and women are reading them, understanding it, maybe more than us, Nancy and I, since we've never served in the military. But for Nancy and I, a lot of what you're writing is new to us, and we can get into your stories. And you're telling the true stories. We can dig into it. So I think that you also have an audience. If we get it, I know a lot of other people that don't know much about military history are getting it because you do involve that human side. So do you feel that with what you've written over the years?
Well, that's really what I try to accomplish. Every story that I write, I always try to include the human element in there, and I always try to give a perspective of what's happening from a soldier's eye view. Yeah, I feel that the more I can incorporate the human elements into these stories, the more that they'll resonate with a lot of the broader readership out there, because it's really the soldiers themselves who drive these stories, and it's really them, the people who participated in these conflicts on the front lines, that really have the most intimate tales that need to be shared. And I think it's from them that you can learn probably the most important lessons for any future generations. So, if ever there's a conflict again, it's either like this one that I've just written about, you know, when you put the personal element in there, I think it makes a more meaningful lesson for anyone who has to learn from history.
Mm. It seems also that a lot of the people you're writing about, the soldiers you're writing about, and women are included in that. That
they are.
They're often from an underdog perspective, too. You know, that you wouldn't think that they would kick ass, and they do at the beginning. You know what I mean?
Right.
In life.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That has actually been a recurring theme in a lot of the stories that I've written about. You know, I get a lot of tales from these veterans, and I get a lot of stories from people who have survived. And when I just follow the story arc of their life, one of the things that they all tend to have in common is that they all come from pretty humble backgrounds. And there's really nothing inside of their direct lineage that would indicate that they would become some of the monumental heroes and do the heroic things that they went on to do. And it really just goes to show that, there's a little bit of heroism inside of everyone. And
mm-hmm.
It really doesn't take anything special to be able to dig down deep and rise to the occasion.
You know, one of the things that I think about is when, you know, you watch these films and you read your books and, I'm kind of fascinated by what it's actually like to be in it and have,
mm-hmm.
I just want to use the word face that, I mean, because when you're told to do something by a commanding officer, higher ranking officer, you have to trust that that is correct. You know,
right.
And that's a hard part for me because I'd be all like, oh, well, I'm not sure I want to do it that way. You know? So there's got to be some kind of level of faith that says, okay, you know, you've been told to do it this way. Maybe part of you
mm-hmm.
goes, well, I don't think that's the right way. But that's where I find it interesting where I don't know. I probably should never be in the armed forces because I'd be like, nah, I don't think I want to do it that way. I want to do it this way. So do you think that happens on battlefields where somebody goes, well, I don't think so.
Right. Well, from my own experiences being in the military, what I've seen, and I think this would be echoed by a lot of other veterans out there, is that when you're a subordinate or, if you're in any type of middle management position, there's always going to be a fine balance between having trust in
mm-hmm.
those who are above you
mm-hmm.
and being able to make your own independent decisions about what's going on and also what needs to be done. I think trust is probably one of the hardest things to earn when you're
mm-hmm.
in a position of leadership, and
mm-hmm.
it's also one of the easiest things to lose. So I think
mm-hmm.
really a good leader is one who can demonstrate to all of his subordinates through continuous training, through a lot of practical exercises that they do, that yes, given all of the different scenarios that we may find ourselves in, I can prove to all of my subordinates during all these training exercises that I know what I'm doing and that
mm-hmm.
I can effectively operate under pressure and that I can put a general plan in place that will more than likely succeed on the tail end of the conflict. And if he
mm-hmm.
can do that, then that's probably the biggest point of inspiration to those beneath him that, you know, when they do get into, you know, a situation where it's for real, then they say, okay, well, if the higher-ups say to do this, I can generally safely conclude that it's the right
yeah.
decision and I have no problems following it. But even still, you see a lot of instances in history where, you know, even some of the most highly trained people, when all the bullets start flying and when,
mm-hmm.
you know, grenades start going off in everyone's face, that, when the stakes are high and everything's going a mile a minute, sometimes the decisions that higher-ups make are not really the best
mm-hmm.
ones. And
yeah.
it's those subordinate leaders who are closest to the action that have to be relied upon and they have to be listened to in order to make the right call. And as a matter
mm-hmm.
of fact, there's an example from Hollywood that I can give you.
Mm-hmm.
If any of your listeners out there are familiar with a war movie that came out about 20 years ago called The Thin Red Line. It was dealing with Army units in the Pacific. And there was one particular scene in the film where you had these two actors. You had Gary Busey, who was playing the who was playing the brigade commander, or I think he may have been a battalion commander, but he was giving an order to a company commander, a captain who was being played by Elias Koteas. And the scene was both of them arguing back and forth about what course of action was the best to attack this enemy position. Well, you had Gary Busey's character who was saying, I think you should do this. But then Elias Koteas, he was saying, no, I really think that we should do this. We should go to the south. We should make a reconnaissance in force. And he even says on the radio point blank, I am here. I can actually see this situation happening in front of me. If we follow your orders, we're all going to get killed. I am not going to lead these men to their deaths.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So following that very brief and very intense power struggle, you know, Gary Busey's character finally yielded and said, okay, I'll allow it, but, comma, my order still stands, you know.
Whoa. Wow. See, but it's interesting with that too, you know. And speaking of leadership, I want to tell people we've got an amazing gentleman joining us, Jim Pidgeon, who's a U.S. Navy veteran. Now, I know that you're an Army veteran. Are we going to have problems, Mike?
Not at all. I think of all the services, the Army and the Air Force, they tend to get along the best.
Well, he's a U.S. Navy veteran. He served on the USS Kitty Hawk as a flight deck troubleshooter during the Vietnam War. And he is really active with MVETS. I mean, locally in his hometown of Tulare, California, where we met him just a few weeks ago. And I think it's not even was it 10 days ago, actually, Nancy, think about it. I think it's exactly. I can't keep up. But anyway, locally. Go ahead, Mike.
Oh. I was just going to say, if he's a Navy vet, I won't hold that against him.
I knew this. It's going to start. I know it. But, yeah, he does a lot in regards to the local and California's and national MVETs as a leader in so many levels. He's, you know, got medals and awards for what he's done. He's also co-founder of the 22 Everyday Push-Up Challenge, and that promotes awareness for veteran suicide prevention. While honoring military service members and veterans, and what he's done is amazing. He's also an incredible singer-songwriter, and so we're going to play his song 22 every day. We always have music on the shows. So looking forward to this. And I think, you know, it goes hand-in-hand with what you're doing, Mike, and we'll talk about Days of the Fury, but I think even that book, too, I think that it helps that the stories are out there. I think it helps for the veterans. What do you think? I mean, you're a veteran. You've interviewed Ghost Troop. I mean, you interviewed as many people as you could in that. And I know that's not easy to do that. And I want to talk about that process as well. But to have their stories told, especially those who have been in combat, do you think it helps the veterans?
Absolutely, it does. I think for a lot of them, the process is therapeutic, and I think it helps them. I think it also helps them achieve a lot of closure. You know, they come back from these conflicts. There's a lot of emotional trauma that they carry with them. And, you know, just to know that they have an advocate out there who is also a fellow veteran, I think that helps them want to share more. And I think that makes them more receptive to trying to get their stories down on paper, you know, trying to let the general public and future generations of veterans know that this is what really happened and this is what all we went through. And, you know, also to serve, I guess, as a clarion call to, you know, any number of decision makers out there that if ever again you feel the need to send somebody in harm's way, just know that this is going to be the downstream effect of what happens.
Yeah, I think it's interesting with the Days of Fury and also Going back, I know you were on the show, the last one, we talked about Hal Moore and also the museum, his museum in Bardstown, Kentucky. Everyone, it's the story's featured in Parks and Travel magazine. Go to nationalparktraveling.com. We visited the museum, and Mike is well known for writing about Hal Moore and writing with him. Hal Moore, A Soldier Once and Always, chronicling his life. And we just watched the movie We Were Soldiers, starring Mel Gibson. I know we're late, Mike, but we got there. Finally, it came to Hulu. You know we travel. It's like, you know, but we finally got to really sit and watch it. And I actually think I have watched it before, but I just didn't put it all together. And we couldn't believe it. We're like, finally, we can watch this. And it just, it really brought home, you know, we've talked about Hal Moore, and you've got, you know, more than one book on him. You also have the leadership values and just it, what you're doing and how he was in Days of Fury, all kinds of goes together in a way of looking at the situation. It's not like the military says, here's your perfect scenario. That's kind of what I got out of it. And Nancy's been reading Days of Fury and running out and telling me everything every 5 seconds. And I know, and I've been reading it too, but she's well into it. And she's like, I didn't know this. I didn't know that. And about, so it's really, this is something that's important. And everyone, MikeGuardia.com, by the way, and all his books, and there's many, are on Amazon. So go get them. But there's something where, you hear what Nancy was talking about, the leadership trust, and how much harder is it when you really aren't served the perfect platter to continue the job? Not, I'm not going against the military. You know what I mean? Am I going to get in trouble?
No.
You know what I mean? It's never, a battle is never a perfect scenario whatsoever, right?
And as a matter of fact, it's a longstanding idiom in the military that no plan survives first contact.
It, you know, growing up in the 60s and during Vietnam and all the press about not going there, being there, this is wrong, that's wrong, that was a very confusing time when you're looking at any authoritarian group, whether it be the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, the police. You know, it was kind of an era of, we don't like any of it, tear it all down, but we don't really know what we're talking about because we don't know how to rebuild it. Just saying, I'm going to get a lot from that. But, you know, there's a humanity portion that I think books and films bring to the forefront that when you're just reading a newspaper article isn't there. You know, the real understanding comes from talking to people like you, reading books like what you write, and even watching films, even though I know Hollywood's Hollywood and maybe everything in the film isn't exactly what really happened, because I think their part is trying to portray the emotions to get you interested, to make you remember the film.
And feel.
So, and to feel something about it. So, you know, I mean, when I watch a movie, then I don't expect it to be 100% accurate of everything that happened, because the people who were writing it weren't probably there and probably don't know actually what really happened. So everybody's taking different writings and interviews and whatever, and the best that they can, placing it together to hope to allow the viewers to come into that world. And sometimes the viewers don't want to, they may be watching it, but they're watching it with colored glasses in a respect of how they were brought up, if that makes any sense. Like, I know how I was brought up, and I would probably watch a film in a different way than someone who was brought up totally different and come out with a totally different idea. Does that make sense?
Right. It sure does. Yeah. You know, they, every war film that Hollywood has put out, you know, always has a little bit of color commentary that's added into it. Yeah, they they tend to want to have a flair for the dramatic, I think, you know, just mm-hmm. for the sake of, you know, trying to make it more, I guess, artistically appealing to the mass audiences.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I've always found that the best films and even the best books are always ones that try to incorporate that human element in there, you know,
mm-hmm.
try to dive into, you know, some of the complex characters that mm-hmm. made these conflicts turn out the way that they did.
Mm-hmm. I said when watching, you know, Hal Moore, you know, and, you know, over the years talking to you about Hal Moore being in this museum, mm-hmm. seeing his home, it just was really, yeah, and I think that movie was pretty straight up after, you know, reading mm-hmm. your book. You know, I know this wasn't, like, over-colored, and I know that they were part of the process, him and his wife, mm-hmm. and she was amazing. I didn't really quite get her reach until I watched that, I have to say, her reach and what she did. I mean, I think that's the other part of it is what are the families, you know, going through at home.
Mm-hmm.
It's a huge, huge part, and I really respected the movie doing that. And I know that movie influenced you too, but I think it's also important going beyond a movie or the books that you put out, because you're writing as factually as you can. Like with Ghost Troop, let's talk about them, because you had to find these guys,
sure.
right? And you couldn't mm-hmm. find everybody.
Correct.
And so and we should talk about who Ghost Troop is. So let's back up
okay.
a little bit. Days of Fury.
Sure.
This comes off of another book, right? So this
yes.
was, you didn't want to let this story go.
No. So actually the idea for Days of Fury grew out of another book that I did called The Fires of Babylon,
mm-hmm.
which was examining the Battle of 73 Easting from the perspective of Eagle Troop. And I think probably a wider swath of the book buying public is more familiar with Eagle Troop because that was the unit that was commanded by what was then a young Captain H.R. McMaster, long before he became the National Security Advisor in the Trump administration. So I actually had the chance to interview H.R. at length when he was still on active duty. Actually, we were both on active duty at the time. I was a captain.
Wow.
He was a 2-star general, and I had the chance to interview him at length, and he put me in touch with a lot of the other Eagle Troop veterans that he was still in contact with. And ironically enough, what really was a boon for me in finding a lot of the other Eagle Troopers out there was Facebook, because a lot of them were connecting with each other, and you know they were also members of these Facebook forums that you know were specifically addressed to veterans of the battle, or, you know, just thank veterans in general.
Hmm.
And it was in the course of me researching that story and in the course of me writing it, where I really discovered that, you know, Eagle Troop did a tremendous job at the Battle of 73 Easting, but their actions tied in very closely with Ghost Troop, which was fighting on their left flank. And as I was putting all the pieces together, I finally told myself, you know, I really can't tell the full story of 73 Easting unless I tell it from Ghost Troop's perspective as well.
Hmm.
And it was in the summer of 2015, after Fires of Babylon came out, that I decided to take up the task to try and gather as many Ghost Troopers as I could to speak with and see if they would share their stories with me, because I really wanted to get a full picture of the battle and, you know, just kind of highlight a lot of the operational differences between Eagle Troop and Ghost Troop, and how even though they operated somewhat differently from each other, they all fit into the bigger picture of America's victory at 73 Easting. Mm-hmm. And you know, I found that so many of the Ghost Troopers were more than willing to share their stories. And you know, it was just an incredible experience for me to interview all of these guys, incredible people, you know, who have done some amazing things in their lives. And it was just an honor to be able to sit down with a few of them and, you know, hear their stories. And, you know, even to be able to share some of the more unpleasant aspects of their deployment was just an incredible honor to get that down on paper. And, So my goal really was to paint that operational picture as intently and as intimately as I could.
Wow. And like you were saying earlier too, having you being a veteran, talking to other veterans, there's it's almost like a family, right? I know as a musician, and Nancy, both of us musicians, and being in bands, and a musician comes on a show. If they don't know I'm a musician, and we have another musician co-host, I'll talk to the other musician more. You know what I mean? It's like, I'm like, hey, dudes, it's me too. You know, I know about that family. You know, and there is a family. We have family, like these family groups, things where, you know, musicians, we go out on the front line of whatever happens when you go on stage. Even doing live radio shows like today, you never know what's going to happen. You're putting yourself out there 100%. And you're all taking that together, and there's a vibe. There's no, I can't compare it to the military, obviously, when you guys go out there on the front lines. Absolutely can't. All I can say is, in our way, you're, you know, they say public speaking is one of the scariest things to do. And I know, like, I have a hard time. I'm one of them, believe it or not. I can sing, and I can really sing, but I cannot get up on stage and say, hi, everybody, believe it or not. So there it is. Now it's a little different, but that same feeling of camaraderie, and you need that. And I think that's what makes good leadership too. Like, I'm going back to Hal Moore again. I'm sorry, but like, he was like, I'm on the ground with you before and after, like the whole thing, you know, I'm with you. I'm not just going to sit there and direct. I'm in it. And I think that's something that, when you're in battle, you're in it, and you don't want someone just sitting on the sidelines and dictating what to do, right? You want you, does that even occur?
It's occurred a lot, and you know it occurs both in and out of the military. You know, you have a you know, there's a whole swath of leaders out there who prefer to lead from the rear, who make uninformed decisions from ivory towers, and you know, that they presume that they know better than those who are on the ground and who are closest to the action, you know, whether it's a business or whether it's in the military. Yeah, I mean, they're out there. They're out there.
Oh, yeah, we know.
Well, but that's for sure. There's to me, it's like two sides of the fence. What's morally right, or what's your bottom dollar? And there's some who choose morally right, and others who choose what's the best for my bottom dollar. And therein lies the decision-making process for a lot of people.
It's hard. And I think when you're in a situation of battle, you're, I mean, that's got to be so difficult. It just, because you also, you want to save your butt, you know, it's scary. All I know is Nancy and I can only go through what we've been through in life, where it's been life or death situations, and that's all I can go on. And we've had a lot of those situations in our life, not military, but guns in our head or whatever. So I think that's kind of close enough. And you have to. I was going to say, you have to trust who you're with at that time, or know not to trust them, and make your own plan. And if you have a bad leader, do you thwart them? You know what I mean? So that's what I love about your writing and what you're doing, is you're sharing all those different lineages. I do want to go to, you've got Ghost Troop, the Battle of 73 Easting. Every time I hear the Battle of 73 Easting, it sounds so British to me. You know, when I hear,
really?
I don't know what it is. Okay. I always just think, we're like, are we going to England with this? What's going on?
Well, yeah, it's a pretty unusual name for a battle, and it's really just a function of the terrain that it was fought on, because you had the flat and featureless deserts of Iraq, where there was no identifiable landmarks for miles on end, and you know, when you're just in the middle of a flat desert and you're engaging the enemy essentially out in the middle of nowhere. You know, you really don't have anything to identify the battle by, except for where it happens on a map. And an easting actually refers to the longitudinal grid lines that you find on a military map. And so they say, okay, well, if we have this particular section of a map and all of these grid lines are going in successive order, well, if we're making contact at this particular point on the map, then we're just going to call it, okay, the battle of here's an easting, and the number that matches to it, 71, 72, okay, 73 Easting it is. Yeah.
Hmm. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, so just call it. That's it. Okay. So let's go to this. This was all part of Operation Desert Storm, and which is, you know, the Greater Gulf War, right? And before we went on air, I was talking about, like, knowing, you know, where this was happening in high school, and I'm going back on the dates. And absolutely, when I was in high school, that's when it was going down. And, you know, we would always say, like, if something was bad, and there was bad stuff going on in South Africa at the time we were there, right, Nancy? That's kind of where I was going with, you know, we've had all these things happen. And we did. We had riots. We ended up in riots, not willingly, just swept up in them, and it's scary when it's mob craziness. We could go on and on. But at that point, like all of us, you know, kids, teenagers, we were sitting there going, well, you know, not as bad as being in a concentration camp in Kuwait. That was our thing. That was this, I don't know, it was like this running saying that was going on, and that you wouldn't, you know, be able to get outside and go play or not play or whatever, do whatever shenanigans we wanted to get up to at that age. But it was the running thing. And, you know, South Africa is part of that continent, you know, and you start thinking about the Middle East and what was going on. It was very connected. And it was kind of scary, you know, just thinking about what was going on. And that was a new era because I think, you know, World War One, World War Two, Vietnam was always big. The Korean War, many of us don't think of it. That gets kind of left under the blanket, though it's very prominent. And then, Nancy, you were carrying on about this today, you know, too. I mean, this was a different generation of soldiers. It was a new era. It my kind of your era, my era, I'm a little older, but kind of this new generation of soldier and then different rules, right, in a way.
Right. Yeah. It really took a lot of us by surprise, I think, because it just the whole nature of the conflict kind of seemed a little bit anachronistic. It was, you know, here we were at the end of the Cold War, and we thought, okay, well, now that the Soviet menace has gone into the dustbin of history, we really don't have a big peer-to-peer threat anymore. And, you know, most of what we're going to be doing from here going forward is probably just going to be training for an eventual conflict, but we don't know who we're really training to fight against. Maybe it might be the North Koreans. Maybe it might be Iran. But, you know, we at least thought for the foreseeable future, well, gosh, you know, maybe aside from a token peacekeeping mission here or there, there's not going to be a whole lot for us to do. But then all of a sudden you had Saddam Hussein, who was in command of the fourth largest army in the world, you know, suddenly and deliberately invade Kuwait. And we were thinking to ourselves, okay, well, this guy has the fourth largest army in the world. It's the largest in the Middle East. He has a very tank-heavy force that, you know, is filled to capacity with the latest and greatest of Soviet armor, the same type of mechanical threats that we were preparing to square off against for years during the Cold War. Looks like we're going to have one more big conventional war after all. And yeah, it was something that we did not anticipate it going quite as well as it did, because, you know, simply because, you know, Saddam had strength in numbers, and there were several strategic analysts and talking heads on the media who were anticipating as many as 20,000 casualties on the first day of the ground war alone.
Wow.
Yeah, and we were expecting quite an intense fight between ourselves and the Iraqi Republican Guard.
Go ahead, Nancy. Sorry.
No, I was just going to say it's really interesting because where does the information really come from, and how much of it can you trust? You know, there's so much in the media, and then you. Yeah, there's almost, the media is almost divided. I'm talking about major newspapers, they're almost divided.
Yeah.
And so it's like if you listen, I don't want to say particular stations, but if you listen to that station, it's all going this way. And if you listen to other stations, It's going a different way. And so as for news media, it's become now, how do you trust the news media? Or who do you trust?
Right.
You know, and sometimes I think as viewers, you might like a certain presenter or find them funny or sarcastic, or you will like to watch it because it's interesting, it's entertainment,
mm-hmm.
not news.
Right.
You know, in some regards, I feel like we've gone from news to entertainment instead of news. You know what I mean? I think it confuses the issues.
And that's really the real trick, isn't it? Because, you know, that's something that I've even noticed in my lifetime. You know, I'm
mm-hmm.
still young enough to remember a lot of the nightly news broadcasts that were happening during the Gulf War.
Uh-huh.
And when I compare that to the quality of the news programs and a lot of the presentation styles that I see today, I really do see a night and day difference. So, you know, I think it's a chore for everybody out there. You know, you don't quite know what news outlet to trust because everyone is saying a slightly different version of the story than everybody else is. You know, does the truth lie somewhere in the middle? And, you know, how many different sources do you have to go to before you can really trust reliable information? And, you know, sometimes even the official record gets it wrong. You know, I mean, there was a particular instance in the Ghost Troop book that I really felt compelled to correct. There was a certain report of an incident that happened towards the tail end of a battle that had been put into the official government report. And for years, this particular version of this particular sub-event was reported like it was the gospel according to St. Luke. And, you know, I find out almost 30 years later that, you know, when I talked to the men in the vehicle who were actually there and saw it happen in real time, they say, well, no, the official version is actually wrong because we were all there. We all saw it and it all happened according to X, Y, and Z, not A, B, and C. And, and it's sad because nobody ever bothered to interview us when they were making the official records.
Wow. But you know, nothing's perfect, right? Because at the end of the day, everything is human. Wars are human.
Yeah.
You know, and people fighting them are human. And that's the beauty of what you're doing is that you're reminding us of what war is. And you always hear on the news, so many troops, this, that. It's like this bulletin board without the humanity. And then sometimes it's humanity if it's Memorial Day or Veterans Day. No offense to those days. It's important. But sometimes I know, like us, you know, with what we do on our shows, we're conversations. We're not news media. Just, you know, we're conversations here and learning ourselves. You know, we learn from you and we appreciate it. And I know our listeners do too. And, you know, it's, do you have all these holidays and celebrations and, you know, it's this day, it's that day. Today is the day that Flanders Fields was written. So that's important. That was in 1915, you know. So to me, that kind of thing is important to note. But some of these holidays, I sometimes wonder, I think they're created so that we don't just hear the news stats, that we do put some humanity and thought into it. But then sometimes I think, why can't we do it every day? Maybe we can't as a human body or brain capacity not just recognize or feel this. I don't know. But what you're doing with your books, I think, is so important because it's someone who has studied this and interviewed people and gone through the labor of putting it together and writing it so that it's something that is comprehensive but something that everyone can read, no matter whether you're someone like, you know, me or Nancy that has not been in battle. And we don't know all the things, you know, all the abbreviations and all of that stuff. But you can get the gist of the story to have an understanding. And then you have those who have served in the military are going to go, I know what you're talking about. And, yeah, you know, someone's telling my story. And then there's the people you've really told their story about, which I think is important. I mean, you're telling a story of my era. And, you know, Operation Desert Storm, the Gulf War, I mean – I feel like we're still battling it, aren't we, Mike? In a way, like, aren't we? Like, you know, Afghanistan, it's like, do we pull out of this? Everybody says no, if there's a big war on that, you know? So in a way, it just is this never-ending war that's going on. And what about the men and women that are part of this? In your book, you talk about an armored cavalry regiment, the U.S. Mm-hmm. Army's 2nd yes. Armored Cavalry Regiment. Tell us about that so we can get an idea, because, you know, the other thing is, you know, it's like, here's these regiments, everybody's going out there, but now it's desert. Do you think about Vietnam was the last, mm-hmm. you know, went in the swamps, and now we're in the desert. Hello. Right. Like, that's suddenly having to be ready for that.
Right. Yeah, so the Armored Cavalry Regiment, that was an organization that was unique to the U.S. Army, and it was quite an incredible organization, and I think it's a shame that it no longer exists according to what the traditional configuration of a cavalry regiment was. But the time, there were three heavy armored cavalry regiments, or ACRs for short. There was the 2nd ACR, there was the 3rd ACR, and then there was the 11th ACR. And these were comparable in size to a modern-day tank brigade, but they were independent, and they were also very rapidly deployable. And their sole purpose was to provide a heavy armored reconnaissance and aerial reconnaissance asset to heavy forces that were deployed in the field. So if you had a conventional heavy division or a conventional tank division, mm-hmm. The ACR would be the mobile heavy armored force that was out in front that would be acting as the eyes and ears either for the division commander or for the corps commander. And these elements there on the front lines, they were expected to conduct some forward reconnaissance and also make first contact with an enemy force before handing the battle off to the follow-on forces to ensure their destruction. It was basically a built-in early warning system for all of the conventional follow-on forces so that those higher echelon commanders could make decisions based upon the enemy contact reports that the ACR was making.
Wow. So this is a huge deal. Now, mm-hmm. can I ask you my girly question of the night?
Sure.
No, I always do this.
Go, girly.
Okay, so you got Eagle Troop and you've got Ghost Troop. You know, I always want to know about both of us, mm-hmm. too, Nancy. You're part mm-hmm. of this. Mm-hmm. You know, naming of aircraft, you know, naming of tanks. So naming of mm-hmm. troops, who does that?
Okay, so typically that is done at the squadron level, or the individual troops can get together and they can vote on a name that they want, and then the squadron commander can bless off on it. So in a typical armored cavalry squadron, you will have some very colorful names for a lot of the troop elements there. And, you know, troops are going to be the equivalent of the companies in all of the conventional units. So instead of having Alpha Troop or Bravo Troop or Charlie Troop, either the squadron commander or the individual troop commanders can be as creative as they want to be. They can say, hey, I want to call this troop, I want to call it Apache Troop, or mm-hmm. I want to call it Avalanche Troop, or, you know, some mm-hmm. might even get more creative and say, I want to call it Anarchy Troop or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It really just depends on one, the creativity, and if the incoming commanders want to continue on the tradition of keeping the particular troop name. To this day, I think Eagle Troop is still being called Eagle Troop. I mean, it is still part of the 2nd Cavalry Regiment, but I think the Eagle Troop moniker still remains. And, you know, but it really could change on the dime. You know, you could have a unit called Bandit Troop, you know, and they could have the Bandit Troop name for 25 years. But then a new troop commander comes in and says, okay, well, I think we've been Bandit Troop long enough. Do you guys have any ideas for a new troop name? Or do you want to keep the old Bandit Troop name? And if they vote on a new name, you know, then that is unofficially what it becomes. My old company down at Fort Bliss, I actually did the same thing. I was in a tank company. It was Charlie Company. And, the brigade that I was in wanted to be creative with naming its company. So at first we were Chaos Company.
Oh.
yeah, but then probably 2 years or so after I left the company, I started talking to a lot of the alumni back there.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, okay, well, it used to be Chaos Company. Now we're called Cobra Company.
Oh.
Don't mess
with that.
I mean,
does that make you feel
things can
bad? Does that make you feel bad? Or, like, did you feel like, oh, they changed the name? Or does it not, like...
Well, no, it didn't really make me feel bad. I just thought that, gosh, I didn't know that it would be that easy to change it. You know, I figured that, I just figured that if, the inaugural name of the company was Chaos Company, then that's what it was going to be forever and ever. But, I figured that any change to the name would be, you know, like coming down through an official order and a memorandum for record and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But, no.
Huh.
Yeah. Well, listen, bands do it. I'm going back to the music thing. Bands change a Jefferson airplane to Jefferson Starship.
Oh,
they went from an airplane to beaming up. You
it's
know,
hardly
so
the same thing.
Van Halen was going to change their name, and then that didn't happen. But because
no.
Some of those names are really bad. But it does happen. You know. But okay, so last question. I know because we're already going to start running out of time. But Mike, for you writing both of the books on both troops with the battle, you know, that, here we are. I'm sorry, but when you think about it, British. The 73 East thing is British. Days of Fury, when you think about it, does that connect closer for you personally because of the era that you served in the military?
Well, I think it connects personally to me in the sense that these are soldiers that had the same occupational specialty that I did. You know, we're talking with soldiers who served in tank units. We're talking about the concepts of armored warfare. So, I think that's where the personal connection begins. And I think at the same time, the personal connection for me was really just, you know, being where I am in the timeline. I'm one of the elder group of millennials, and we were in grade school when the Gulf War was kicking off, and the first major conflict that really occurred during our lifetimes. I mean, we were too young to remember Vietnam. A lot of us weren't born then, but this was our first introduction to, you know, this is what's happening on the world stage, and this is what a war looks like. So kids take this in, you know, because when you're grownups, you're probably going to be seeing a lot more of this.
It is like that, you know, growing up in Africa most of my life. In England, you know, England, everybody was still stuck on World War II and told Nancy and I that we were
so
late for
true.
The war, and I had no idea what they were talking about.
I know. We were like, what are you talking about?
Yeah, you know, I wasn't
everywhere
there.
Everywhere we went, they said, oh, the Americans were late for war. We were late coming
into like, my mama always told
World
me to be
War
punctual. You know,
well,
like,
we saved them from speaking German, so,
yeah,
you know,
exactly.
I mean, there's that.
We might have been late, but we kicked butt.
But I mean, it was just different. But in Africa, there were always wars. There was the Anglo-Boer War, not Anglo-Boer War, but that was way beyond. But Angola was going on at the time when I was in high school and stuff. And so it was scary because a lot of my friends ended up in military, especially out of high school. Men, you know, young men, you either served 2 years of mandatory military or you had to go to college. And if you went to college, you're doing your military service after that. No matter what you do, you're going to
you're
military
going
service.
Yeah.
Kind of like Israel does that with men and women. And, you know, I watched what happened to a lot of my friends who didn't know what they were getting themselves into and didn't know. And it was, I mean, you just didn't
know. How can you possibly
know? And you weren't well-equipped a lot of times. And I'm still going to get emails after this. And at the same time, though, it wasn't like – everybody's got a different personality or who they are. It was like, you're shoved in. That's it. And if a war was going on at that time or a smaller battles, we're talking Africa, everything was going on and it could be a riot that suddenly you're in and you're not a person who can deal with that kind of thing. I personally had people real close to me try to commit suicide when I was in high school. You know, they were graduates. And, I mean, I didn't understand at a young – I didn't understand what was going on. And I wish I knew better. And I wish there was more awareness. And I know we're going to talk about that later on the show, but I wish I understood, and I didn't. But there was a lot of that. Just within your friends graduating and having to go, not knowing. And, you know, I look at Vietnam War, and I look at, you know, even – young men and women that do sign up, maybe, I don't know what happens from there on. Do they get put in the right position that they belong in or not? And I just go from my friends in South Africa, and some of them didn't come out very good. They didn't come out healthier.
But you have to, you have to remember you're in a different continent with different economic problems.
But it was... It was really scary as a person in high school watching what was going on, and we were making these jokes about Kuwait. But you make those jokes when you're scared, you know, and you just wondered if the friends you're graduating with, what's going to happen with them, because they're going to be forced in. Seriously,
It was really hard to look at the group of Lisa's friends and hear that they're now entering the military. And I could look as a parent, looking at the lack of knowledge of what was about to happen to them. They suddenly have a reality-based opinion of how it was presented and how there was a certain amount of pride on the parents' part that their children were doing good by doing their duty as a citizen. But there was also a blind eye to what was really about to happen. And it was really kind of sad, because I knew her friends pretty well. They spent a lot of time at our house. I'm like, you're so not ready to do anything close to any kind of combat or military service. They're kids. And I mean, really kids, and I'm not putting them down at all, but emotionally and mentally ready for what was about to happen, it wasn't there. And I don't think the training... So I'm going to get in trouble for that one, but the training wasn't there either.
No, it was too. You're in it. And
the training wasn't there. And I think that's a problem worldwide. You know, that training and equipment fall behind. And in my personal viewpoint is training and equipment, finances for equipment and new equipment fall behind because of our political representatives. And I'm just going to leave it at that.
Well said.
Mm-hmm.
That's a global situation. But
yeah,
I think
it is
interesting. It's interesting in South Africa because at the end of the day, too, the army is who taught me how to play soccer, and I was pretty good at it.
Anyway.
On the fun side of it. But, yeah, Mike, I mean, this country, do you ever see that? I mean, the draft for Vietnam was kind of like that,
mm-hmm.
right, in a way? I mean,
I think a lot of the draft and the personnel policies that were in place during Vietnam were very counterproductive and also incredibly inefficient. But one thing that I can say with every degree of certainty is that we learned a good lesson from it. We learned what mistakes that we did not want to repeat. And one thing that I can also say with complete certainty is that the U.S. military is both the best trained and the best equipped fighting force anywhere in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And that the training that I went through far and away was the best training that I think any military has to offer anyone who joins.
Mm-hmm.
And, that's why from a tactical standpoint, our forces continue to do so well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, so listen, we've got Jim Pigeon joining us next, and we're going to swap some music around here because of time, because we went over time, because we do well on that. But I actually want this to happen this way, too. Everyone, again, before we bring Jim on, please go to MikeGuardia.com, and the book, again, is Days of Fury, Ghost Troop and the Battle of 73 Easting. You can get it on Amazon, like his other books, too. And Hal Moore, the new version is out. The second, is it like the second edition, we should say, for Hal Moore?
Yes. So the paperback edition of the Hal Moore biography that came out in 2013, they've just entered it into a new paperback edition that's going to be out this August.
Mm. All right. So everybody, stay tuned. Keep up with Mike at MikeGuardia.com, and Mike's going to stay on the line with us and guest co-host, and keep us in line, Mike.
Yes.
I know. Okay. We're going to get a lot of emails from whatever we say, so I'm sorry. But anyway, stay tuned. We have a great guest joining us. We're going to play his song in a second, too.